Hello, TSF family. We wanted to start off by saying thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast and for your hard work to love yourself more and for your feedback.
Can you believe it's been 3 years that we've been doing this spiritual fix, and it has been such a beautiful labor of love for Anna and me.
We have loved doing this work. We've loved hearing from you, and we love exploring ourselves and each other alongside our listeners.
We wanted to put out the call for 3 ways that you can help support us to support you.
One, we would love you to leave us a review on iTunes or follow us on Spotify.
2, drop us an email and let us know how much the podcast means to you.
And 3, you can donate monthly or even just once to our PayPal patronage.
Every little bit helps, and we are so grateful to those of you who have donated already. Thank you.
You help make this podcast possible.
Thanks, y'all.
You can go to our website, www.thisspiritualfix.com, for information on how to pledge as well as to email us.
Hello, TSF family, and welcome to episode 17 of season 7 of This Spiritual Fix. Today we are going to be doing part 2 of How to Communicate with Your Villains. Enjoy.
Hypnosis. Mindfulness. Meditation. Past life regression.
This spiritual fix. Two mystical mamas hacking the self-help game.
With Anna Stromquist
and Christina Wiltsey.
Hi, Anna.
Hey, Christina.
How are you doing today?
Good. I'm looking forward to us finishing up the episode, or part 2, I should say, of the 2-part episodes on communicating with villains. I feel like this is really groundbreaking stuff. I love it.
Me too. I'm excited as well. But in the meantime, you wanted to talk a little bit about the Vengeful Martyr and how it's been showing up in your life. And as a reminder to everybody, Vengeful Martyr is all about what is the energy that you are using to nourish yourself, and what are you using to nourish other people, and what are the boundaries that you have between them. We use the word boundaries a lot, but if you think of boundaries, we think of boundaries as like, how are you balancing what you're spending on other people versus yourself, with the recognition of the fact that, like, when you nourish yourself, you naturally have the energy to nourish other people.
Yeah. So what came up for me, actually, when I was in my peak vengeful martyr state, it was probably when I was extremely sleep deprived, nutrient deprived. I was breastfeeding. I was doing sleepless nights, all that. It's when I had 2 kids in diapers, basically. Right. And it was at that time in my life that, up until then, I prided myself on never having any cavities. Right. But when I was in this very vengeful martyr state of my spiritual cycle, we could say, or whatever, I got my first cavities, and my dentist was like, "What is going on with your teeth? Like, you've always had great teeth and you've got all these things going on." I don't even remember how many cavities I had, but I was nursing at the time. And I'm like, I had been nursing like 2 kids back to back. And I'm like, well, maybe the breastfeeding took the calcium out of my bones or my teeth. Like, I don't know. But I always thought that, like, somehow my bad teeth were completely tied up in being a martyr. And now you have this term for it, the vengeful martyr, right? Well, last month I went to get my teeth cleaning, and they were like, "Your gums are so bad. We don't even want to clean your teeth because your gums are so bad. We don't have room for you because you need so much extra cleaning." But yeah, I didn't have cavities though. They're like, "You're going to have to make another appointment." And this dentist's office is like really, really out of my way. Like, I was already having to drive 45 minutes out of my way because it's like downtown. I live in the suburbs, but I would make the trip because I was extremely loyal to my dentist and I loved him. And they're like, "You need to come back." So I'm like, I just wasted an hour and a half just driving. Forget the parking. But anyways, I'm driving home and I'm like, "Oh, this makes me so upset that, like, my teeth are so bad. Like, I'm a horrible, horrible person that I let my gums get so bad. And I'm a terrible flosser and I'm a terrible water picker and woe is me." And then I start to think about it. I'm like, last time I had teeth problems was when I was in my vengeful martyr stuff, right? And then I started thinking, okay, I'm going to reframe this and see this as an opportunity to not be a vengeful martyr and, like, get out of the martyr system. Like, what is martyr-ish about my gums? And then I start to realize, like, I get eyelash extensions. I have microblading on my eyebrows. I'm quick to get my roots colored when I get grays coming in. Like, I'm very quick to take care of my things, my hygienic things, when other people can see them. But when they're things that pertain to me, like my own pap smears and physicals and flossing, I'm like really bad about it. I'm really bad about making those appointments, and I'm really bad about flossing. So I was like, screw it. I am going to take flossing and water picking. I'm going to take this as a symbolic act of nourishing myself and taking care of the things that people don't even see. Like, no one really sees my gums. I'm going to like take extra care of these for me and for nobody else. Like, this is going to be my own self-nurturance. So I went to the drugstore, I bought mouthwash and dental floss and some picks just for the car, so that like after lunch, when I'm on the go, I can still take care of my teeth. And after every meal, I've been flossing and water picking, and my gums are awesome now. And I decided to get a new dentist because I wasn't going to get one that made me feel shameful. I was going to get one who was more convenient to me, that was close to my home, because I'm not a martyr anymore. I'm not going out of my way for other places that I can just get the same thing done locally. And anyways, that's been kind of part of my vengeful martyr experience. And then something came up recently. I went to an event, a genetics event, and at the end, they gave us a kit to go to take home. It was by J-Screen, but the kit itself was by Myriad, and it was free with this event. But if you're not part of the event, like if you didn't have this promo, it's $49 for the kit. And then insurance may or may not cover this kit. And if they don't, it's $250 out of pocket. Now, this is in 2025 when I'm recording. Their prices might change if you go to Myriad Genetics, and I'll put it in the show notes. But basically, they did a very large genetic screening panel on me to see like what I'm at risk for. And I sent it off. I forgot about it, you know, and then I get an email being like, here's your report. And I read it. And lo and behold, although I knew I was negative for BRCA, I have a mutation which makes me more susceptible to skin cancer, and I'm at 30% risk of getting breast cancer at some time in my life. So I was like, I am not going to be the vengeful martyr about this. I am not going to just sit on this. I'm going to act. I'm going to act now. So I made an appointment with a geneticist. I'm now going to start interviewing or talking to breast surgeons. And I think I'm going to go ahead. It might not be this year, it might not be the next few years, but I'm going to probably get bilateral mastectomies, but that, which I'm okay about, because I just want to like be done with the whole fear of breast cancer stuff. It's very emotional for me, since that's what my mom died of. Just mammograms themselves are just like such a fucking mind trip every time I have to go. Yeah. But that's not the point. The point is not genetic testing. The point is that I'm acting. I'm not sitting on it. I'm not lamenting over it. I'm not being a martyr about it. I'm like, I have the information. I'm going to get it done. Might not be right now, because it might just not be the right time. I have to talk to these surgeons. I got to figure out insurance, blah, blah, blah. But like, I'm going to take care of it. I'm not going to be a martyr. So anyways, I just want to say, if you are a hypochondriac, but then you deny yourself actually going to the doctor for important things, or losing important paperwork regarding doctors, or if you're like me and you don't floss and you just have a hard time being good to yourself, like in those ways, maybe it's time to heal the vengeful martyr and just take better care of your health. Oh, I also started something else, but I'll talk about that another day. Just basically learning that I was skinny fat and macro tracking, because I am a whale apparently, which I didn't even know until.
That's such bullshit.
I
called you a whale.
Well, they didn't call me that, but my friend jokingly is calling me that, because we were shocked to discover that we are skinny fat. But that's a topic for another day.
So I think it's really interesting symbolically, if you think of breasts. Because obviously, like, there are some people who, like, just like there are, you know, breast people and ass people in terms of male gaze or female gaze or whatever, depending on kind of how you look at things, or just gaze of the female body, and who, no matter whoever is doing it, you know, that there are a lot of people who have a lot of pleasure that they get from breasts, right? They like really, there's that pleasure aspect to it. And I think the symbolic action of knowing that breastfeeding is something that literally takes so much out of you. Like, it's literally the act And it's like, I don't know about you, but I used to have to, you know, I used to have those like massive water bottle that was like 58 ounce or 64 ounce, you know, water thing next to me because I would literally start nursing and I felt like a mummy just desiccating, right? It was like that fast how much water you needed. And it was like this exact example of like drinking while you pour, right? Which to me is like an adage of the nourisher, which is the legend of the vengeful martyr, is drink while you pour. Right. And so like literally you would have to be like slurping away while you nursed your child. And, you know, and again, unless it's like a pleasure thing, there's this really symbolic thing, I feel like, in choosing to take care of your own health by getting rid of the functional aspect of your breasts.
You know, I'm getting rid of the thing that nourishes others.
Exactly. Again, there could be pleasure that nourishes you. So it's not like a totally clean, like it's not, you know, it's not like a totally right. clean analogy, but I just think that's interesting, right?
Yeah. It is interesting. And I may not, you know, if I talk to these surgeons and they're like, there's no way that this is a good idea, I'm not going to get it. But at, you know, at present, after talking to the geneticist, it does seem to make sense. But I was like, you know, grieving breast tissue, there's going to be grief, but like that is going to pale in comparison to the stress and heartbreak of constantly having to get mammograms and then, God forbid, actually having to deal with chemo radiation and then even, God forbid, dying from it. Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Can I confound this just a little bit, which is,
yeah.
is interesting. So the device of immortal comes a little bit into this too, because I feel like the vengeful martyr has to do with health, but the device of immortal has a lot to do with health, right? Because it has catastrophizing and there's a lot about the physical body in that one and about death. And it's interesting because your dentist strikes me as a device of immortal because they're catastrophizing and making you feel shame for not taking care of yourself, like, and the loyalty, right? So in the Enneagram, the 6 is the loyal skeptic, right? Like, and so there's a part of this that I feel like, I think it's a really interesting dynamic in that you recognize that your vengeful martyr is going to be fed, but there's also an aspect of your device of immortal that's like sticking up right now. And, you know, and so for me is a slightly different perspective on breast health, because we obviously both have a very similar thing. You know, I recently got, you know, as we kind of all say, like the dense breast tissue crowd here literally has to continually fucking deal with biopsies because we don't actually, or abnormal results because we don't have the anatomy that is like mammograms are designed for, basically, if you can imagine it like that. So you have to get all these extra things, which is hilarious because dense breast tissue people are probably at a higher risk, not just from the lack of diagnostics, but also from the structure, I feel like, in and of itself. Is that right? Like, so it's like, you should actually make mammograms specifically for the people who sit in the highest risk category as opposed to the whatever, but I won't get into that.
Right. Anymore. Right.
And it's been a really interesting thing for me because I've been approaching it from a device of immortal perspective in which fear is the main driver that pushes you into the device of immortal as opposed to the legend of that, which is the healer. And so having to address the fear aspect of it and like everything that everybody and everything that wants to kind of be like, you should be scared. And just being like, no, I could catastrophize this and I'm going to choose not to. Right. So it's like, it's interesting how the same thing can hit in a very different way with a very different villain, depending on what your lenses are, your perspective lenses are.
So you're choosing not to get the mastectomies, right? Mastectomies, because you're saying I'm not going to catastrophize this?
No. So I don't know yet. You basically presented me with like a very logical, good argument as to why I would want to do that. Especially because I spend what, like $4,000 to $5,000 a year out of pocket just on diagnostics.
And then you have to make the appointment and go and be emotional. It's and wait for the results.
Exactly. So there's a lot to be said for wanting to help your future self. I think, and so I don't know, but I've definitely now put that, now that you've been talking about, I've put that into my calculation of just like, what if I didn't do this because I was afraid? what if I didn't even do this because it's inconvenient? What if I did this because it's like, you know, like what are the motivations for me doing this, right? You know, there's like a convenience factor, there's an emotional factor, there's like a fear factor, there's like all of these different things. And for me, where does it sit? Like, what is the thing that my body wants the lesson on this thing in particular? You know, like, what is it? Is it that, you know, I'm supposed to continually be challenged by the medical system, which I always am, right? I struggle so much. Like, I feel like you and like my friends who are in the medical system are literally the things that like keep me still invested in the medical system, because I would not be here otherwise. And so for me, I've been exploring it and I'm like, you're right. This is about taking care of myself. Like, I do constantly take care of other people, and this is an act for me in which I could use this on my vengeful martyr thing, or I could look at it from the device of a mortal perspective and just be like, I don't want to be scared of this anymore. So I can either remove the risk, or I can use the risk as a way to get deeper into my own physical healing and my own understanding of my own homeostasis. Does that make sense?
So, well, I'm trying to understand. So you're thinking maybe either I don't make an action based in fear.
Yeah.
Which is to say, I'm going to keep my breast tissue because I'm not going to be afraid if cancer comes.
Yeah. Or I'm going to be curious about this experience, right? That was one thing that one of our mutual acquaintances, who's a psychic, used to tell me this story. He's told me it multiple times about how in one case he had a family history of cancer and he was going to guarantee to get it. And the other case was that he had a lot of issues with money. He took curiosity instead of fear on the cancer path and literally got it, got diagnosed, got treated, and was done and in remission within 4 months. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, literally just had his cancer experience and moved on. It took him 5 years to get over his money issues, mm-hmm. right? Because he was scared of them, because he was fearful of them, right? So, you know, it's interesting. I feel like I'm kind of confounding your little bit.
It's fine. It's not going to change like my opinion about it. Just because since I work in healthcare, I see what chemo and radiation does to a person. Like, you lose it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I've seen it with my mom, but also just like, I mean, your whole life is going to doctor's appointments, and you spend, you lose a whole year, maybe 2 years, going to these appointments, suffering from the side effects, being exhausted, and then another year just to recover from that hard year. So like, forget that dying of cancer, like that's also a possibility, but just like
treatments. Yeah.
But just, it's the treatments that I'm like, just the treatments, even if it all works out, like, I don't want to give a year of my life to treatments and then a second year recovering.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I see it. Now, does that mean I'm fear-based? I don't know, but
I don't think
I don't want it. I don't want that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm saying, I think that's what I'm kind of trying to say. And I'm glad you pointed that out, because that's not what I was trying to say, because to me, you're being extremely logical about it and not fear-based at all. Like, you're just like, I am literally weighing the pros and cons of this, and this makes sense logically to do this, right? So it's not fear-based at all. Right. To me, my issue with it could be fear-based, which is why acting from fear pushes me further and deeper into the villainous state as opposed to coming out. Does that make sense? It's like
the same issue,
but we both have different villains that are resonating with it. And as a result of it, that's how you, it's like this distinction of like, if I were to jump onto your train, so to speak, jump onto your villain and be like logical about it, I would be negating the fact that there's a fear factor for me.
Right. I see. We may or may not come to the same conclusion, yeah. But you want to get to your conclusion and along the path of getting there, whittle away any villainous belief systems.
Totally makes sense.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Awesome. Well, we still have a bunch of villain communication things to tackle. So let's start with the evasive expert.
Evasive expert, real quick, just 2 seconds before Anna goes into it, is evasive expert is going to be overly intellectual and logical and not have any emotion or have a lot of emotion that sits behind the surface that they're never willing to show you.
So all I have in my notes, very limited, is to say you want to really check in with them somatosensory wise. Like, you want to say things like, that makes sense what you're saying, but how does it feel? Right? Like, you want to ask them feeling questions. You probably want to do things with them to engage their bodies, whether that's, you know, walking, yoga. They probably, if it's your romantic partner, they probably only connect emotionally when they're having sex, I would think, because of their bodies. I don't really know what it looks like. I think they check out. These are kind of avoidance. They check out in conflict.
Classic rejection wound avoidance. Yes.
Okay. So you tell us a little bit about conflict mitigation prevention.
It's a hard one. I have an evasive expert in my life and I ask them how they feel and they're like, does not compute. They just literally are like, I don't know how I feel. That's what they may say. And if they do know how they feel, you know that you're in their dark passenger side. They can become explosively, ragefully angry, very kind of like worse than I would say a tantrum. It can be very violent if they're kind of revealed before they want to, their emotional side is revealed. So one of the best ways to approach them is to make the argument that emotion is part of logic. That's one of the things that I say a lot, is that I say, you know, I remind them to kind of, it may seem like I'm kind of like admonishing them, like anger is an emotion. You know that, right? No, but it's like, all right, let's talk about this logically. This has happened as a result of everything that, you know, A and B happened, and therefore C and D are going to happen as a result of that. Can you logically understand how I might be upset by that? Right. And so you literally put out a logic puzzle in front of them. And I have this, I literally have this argument all the time. It's like, I'm like, so can you see how there's an inconsistency that's existed as a result of this? And every other time that you've done this, this has been, you know, every time that I've done this, this has been your reaction. This time there was a different reaction. So can you help me logically understand why there was a different reaction this time? This is like literally my entire relationship. Like, these are the kind of conversations that we have. They're not super emotion filled. They're very, very logical. They're very just like, we're kind of disconnected from how we feel. Until finally one of those pieces of logic just pierces into that emotional side. And then one person will usually start crying, but it's not rage filled. It's very, very avoidant in general. So when you're having a communication with somebody who's an evasive expert, if you can use, sometimes you can use logic to pierce the emotional shell. But the job is not to be, know that they are in a rejection space and an avoidance space. And the more that if you approach them with emotion, they are going to disappear. They are going to disappear. So approaching them with logic is one of the best ways to outsmart them. Honestly, ideally there's some somatic aspect to it, but they're kind of, they're sometimes really disconnected. And that intellectual part is so strong that it's hard to get through to that.
And if they were in that, you know, beyond tantrum stage, is there a way to help diffuse it? Like, are there certain magic words?
I would say, give them time.
Okay. Okay.
Genuinely, okay. Give them time.
Because so they have to probably process everything very cognitively.
Yes. They have to allow the beast to calm down, put it back in its cage. And then approach it with logic and whips, so to speak, so you can actually approach it in a different way.
All right.
But the more intellectual you can be, and that's really hard. Like, that's really hard for a lot of people to be like, wait, I'm supposed to be logical when I'm angry. It's like, yeah, actually, if you really want to get through with somebody who's deeply in the evasive expert, you do, because they will shut the fuck down if you don't. It's a hard one. All right, divisive immortal. Divisive immortal, they're all about safety, y'all. So the divisive immortal is that stage of, they're exceptionally loyal to people. So they will basically put up with all sorts of shit from you and from everyone around them until they don't. And once they don't, everything flips. And they will literally burn down a relationship and immediately leave it as a result of that. And they're very concerned about safety. So when a person gets into the divisive mortal, they're going to get very catastrophic with their talk. They're going to talk about like, oh my God, but this is never going to be the same. Or like, what are we going to do if we leave our house? They'll jump to the worst possible conclusion. And you're just going to be like, where the fuck did that come from? Your job is to send them back to a space where they are grounded in this reality. And they're like either assured that it's going to be okay if it all goes to shit, or remind them that you're nowhere near that state of catastrophe and that you're trying to reel them back in. and to not effectively break their trust. They're the injustice wounds. So there's a level of rigidity that they have specifically with safety, which is a hard one to kind of see it as.
All right. So I have in my notes that with these people, the divisive immortals, you want to avoid us versus them talk. So like really, really avoid triangulation, really avoid pitting yourself against them so that it's you versus them. It's you and them versus the problem. Remember that one. That's so much more true for this one than anyone else. You really want to stress safety and empathy. And here's a little example. I feel the fear that you are feeling. I understand the fear that you are feeling. Let's look at what we have in common here. Like you keep wanting to come back to what we can, like, let's think, okay, I see that we disagree on this. What do we agree on? Right. You want to like keep emphasizing and bringing back that you're on the same team, that you're not against each other, that there isn't so much duality. You want them to know you're not the enemy. Like if they get in that beyond overwhelm stage, you want to say, I'm not your enemy. I'm not your enemy. I'm on your side. We just disagreeing. Let's come to an agreement together. We're going to get there. We're going to get there. It's going to be okay. You know, like the safety thing. But yeah, you don't want to create more division with these people because that is in a way their biggest...
That is such good advice. As a hardcore divisive immortal, I'm like, yes, please.
Please tell me those things.
Please tell me those things.
Are you listening, Luke? Listen, Luke, are you listening to the podcast? Just kidding.
Seriously, triangulation. I genuinely don't know if there's actually anything worse than that because like I am deeply loyal to so many people. And if somebody's in an argument with me and tells me something about somebody else that they said that you know, like if you were like in an argument with me and you're like, well, Luke told me that you're an asshole, I would be like, what?
I totally agree. My husband and I once got, this is before we had our marriage roles. We got in an argument and he's like, well, even so-and-so's boyfriend said blah, blah, blah about you. And I'm like, what? And it's like, fast forward 15 years, I'm still very uncomfortable around the boyfriend. I'm like, he hates me. He thinks I'm this. You know, it's really bad.
It is. And also that idea of us versus them, like that idea of truly, like you don't surprise them. You don't tell them anything. You know, you don't ever use catastrophic language if you can help it. And if they lose their mind and they, so to speak, if they get bent out of shape, they hit the big top, whatever it is, you may find that they start throwing around words like, I want to get divorced or separated, or I don't think we should be friends anymore, or any of those different things, which means that you have like seriously hit a really hard place to hit in a divisive immortal. And so your job is to, as much as you can, try and diffuse the situation by being like, I 100% understand how serious you're taking this. I can tell that this is like, you know, like you do not downplay their experience. You like recognize how big you fucked up, right? Like, again, with a person mm-hmm. who almost never, ever gets mad at people to a fault, you realize how much you fucked up.
Right. Yeah, very true. All right, we've got anything else on that one, or we go into hungry shapeshifter?
Let's go hungry shapeshifter.
All right. I think the hungry shapeshifter is one of the cutest villains. But anyways, go ahead. Give us a little summary.
Yeah, a hungry shapeshifter is very concerned with attention. They very much so like to keep things lighthearted. They like to be the center of attention. They don't like to be called out in many ways. Like if you ever... humiliate. I use the word humiliate, but if you ever call out a hungry shapeshifter for like the fact that they have many different identities or the fact that they feel like they were totally different in another place, that's like a way to really call out in a bad way a hungry shapeshifter, recognizing that they are going to be constantly changing and being very chameleon in nature is a part of accepting and loving a hungry shapeshifter. Like my family Nice. Makes fun of me for putting on accents all the time. They're like, you're talking to somebody Southern. Why are you putting on your Southern accent? I'm like, just don't fuck around with my accent thing. Like, I hate it when they call me out for that. But it's the way that I connect with other people is I just kind of make them feel Wait. More at ease.
Are you a hungry shapeshifter?
Oh, my God. It's probably like Divisive Immortal is what I became after I got kids. I had kids. Like, it was like what I had to come to terms with. The Hungry Shapeshifter is kind of what I feel like in many ways has been, like, when I was a kid, I always used to talk for attention. I used to constantly want to talk all the time and be the center of attention, which is like a key part of the Hungry Shapeshifter. And I'm kind of like trying to embrace that part of myself at this point.
So remind me, it's Divisive Immortal and Vein Controller combo?
Oh no. So this one's a combination of the Eternal Child and the Vein Controller.
Oh, the Eternal Child. Okay. Right. That's right. Okay. All right. So I have in my notes that you want to invite coherence and curiosity. It's like, hey, you're kind of all over the place and that's amazing. Can you show me which side is most true right now? Or can you show me what's the best part of you wants? What's the best part of you want right now? Right. You could tie it into internal family systems. You recognize that, you know, I recognize you have all these different parts going on, but like your highest self, your higher part, that central part, what does it want? Okay. Well, this is like conflict prevention. What about when they get to their big top?
So I would say they will often shift into a different persona probably when they have their big top, or they're doing it to be like extra dramatic and have attention. So the job is to let them perform. And I know that sounds like a crazy thing, but if you let them perform, right, if you let them just like have their big dramatic moment, and like there was a time in the beginning of my relationship with Luke where I would just be like, I would just get so overwhelmed and kind of just like need to express myself and feel like I hadn't been expressing myself in a specific kind of way. And so I would just have this dramatic blow up, right? Like, and it didn't mean anything. It was, I'd fucking forget about it in 5 minutes, but he took it seriously because most people would, right, at first. But eventually he started to realize that, for one thing, I could just be hungry, but also, but also just that, like, sometimes I needed to express myself, and if it came back again and it kept coming back again, that's when you needed to take it seriously, right? What if it kept cycling around, or if I was like very calm and grounded and in presence and I wasn't being dramatic, then it was like, take me seriously, right? Because then I was in the more legendary form of that arc. But a lot of the time I just needed to like get out of the same old rut of the way that I was talking or the way that things were happening. And so we learned to stop taking as seriously these like dramatic, violent outbursts, not violent, but these dramatic outbursts.
Okay. So as best as you can, if you're with a hungry shapeshifter and they're losing their shit, just let them. Just be the audience.
Yes, be the audience.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. Next one we've got is Righteous Bully, which I gotta say, since doing this work, I am like amazed at how I am not a righteous bully so much at all, or obedient critic. Like, things that used to bother me don't bother me. It's almost like putting her to rest. It's just, I can't even explain it. It's just like kind of incredible. Like, certain things that used to piss me off don't. And I'm like, why isn't it not pissing me off? And I'm like, I guess because it used to only piss me off to give the righteous bully a chance to talk. But now that I'm letting my legend versions come out, she doesn't need to talk. I don't know how to explain it. It's just really cool.
It's really cool, isn't it? It's, yeah. Like, it's so
really cool. Yeah. Like, someone gave me unsolicited parenting advice yesterday. Someone was trying to insist that I get my children phones. Which, I'm not fine if you want to get your kids phones, but like, that's just not our family. And I was like very calmly explaining why it didn't work for us. And they kept insisting that I was somehow depriving my children by not buying them phones. And they're 10 and 12. Okay. And I just was like, okay, okay. Now, usually I would get so fucking pissed, but I didn't. I was just like, whatever. I have so many more things I'd rather do than argue.
It's so true. It's so true. And it's tough, man, because the righteous bully is a scary ass person to be, because in the same vein as the eternal child, where you don't really know what they're going to do, eternal children are usually content to hurt themselves in their flailing. right? Like they'll go out and get in a car accident as opposed to they'll go out and take their car and like hit your house. Like that's the difference between eternal child tantrum and righteous bully experience, right?
Well, righteous bully won't damage their own car. No, they're going to take your car and run it into the trash.
Right, right. Exactly. Okay.
Trust me, I am one and we will not damage our things for you.
And so knowing that, you know, they're the challenger, actually, I found this out the other day, Amy Poehler and Kate McKinnon, they were on Amy Poehler's podcast and they had this really hilarious conversation where Amy Poehler was like, what Enneagram are you? And Kate McKinnon was like, oh, I'm a 4 wing 5. And Kate McKinnon was like, what are you? And Amy Poehler was like, I'm an 8. And then what's your star sign or whatever? And Kate McKinnon's like Capricorn. And Kate McKinnon asked the other thing and Amy Poehler said she was a Virgo. I was like, she's a Virgo righteous bully. Like, holy shit. I don't ever want to run into Amy Poehler. Like, I was just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Intense. I'm sorry. That was a digression. But the whole idea is that righteous bullies are going to find it exceptionally difficult, probably more so than any of the other ones, to accept once they have reached their conflict point. They are going to find it exceptionally difficult to pull back because you cannot tell them an opinion. You cannot tell them like, oh, I think that maybe you could be wrong about this. Like they are in protection mode. They are in mama bear, papa bear, whatever bear mode. They're going to burn things down. Like they will not accept anything other than, you know, trying to diffuse it by effectively speaking as much as you can to that young inner child that feels threatened. As much as possible and trying to placate that inner child that feels threatened in some way or feels that their opinion's not being listened to. But Anna, what do you think about this one? Because you have more.
Well, it's funny because I told my husband what we were going to talk about today. And he's like, what do I say to the righteous bully when she's upset? And I was like, he wants to know. And I was like, we're going to have to ask Christina because I don't know. I think like once I get to that point, there's nothing. There is nothing. There's no way to appease me or calm me down. I don't know if it's true for all righteous bullies. It takes me a lot to get to that state though. But once I'm there, yeah, like there's just no telling how much time it's going to take to come back from it. And I don't know what could help me get out of it quicker.
So what I'm reminded of is I feel like once, you know, cause when we were in our conflict, I was super defensive. I was like the hungry shapeshifter. And you were like, why the fuck are you the hungry shapeshifter? Like, why do you keep moving around who you are and like trying to hide who you are? Like, why aren't you just like coming out in this? And you said to me, the best thing that you can do is to be curious. Right. Which is, that's why I was saying that, like, in some ways, the righteous bully, if you can be curious and listen to their opinion about what's going on, like knowing that this sits in the Ajna Center, knowing that this one is all about like having a very, very strong opinion and wanting to protect people as a result of it. Like you listen to, and you're curious about their opinion and you like allow them to feel listened to and even act on some of it as a result of it, I feel like are things that you can maybe do to help with a righteous bully. Because the righteous bullies that I know who are extreme, you know, they will burn down everything in an effort to kind of trying to make something happen because they've reached some sort of end point. It's like the vengeful martyr times 20. And yet it's all because they have sacrificed in their own mind so much that they want you to be curious and listen to them, right? Maybe it's about you and you, how you need to be fixed. And you just have to sit there and listen to how you need to be fixed. And you can determine whether or not you want to continue a relationship in which you're constantly being told how to be fixed. But when they're in that stage, be curious. Would you say that's true?
Yeah. That's very true. That's very true. Yeah. I think the only recipe is curiosity and trying. I know this is a really big ask. I know it's asking almost the impossible, but also not to be reactive when they're in that state and to just be present with them and like really hear them out. Because I think that at least the self-reflective ones and the ones who aren't, then you make a decision if you want a righteous bully like that in your life or not, right? But like the reflective ones will sit with it and reflect and come back and apologize for the things that they said. But I think that if in the moment that they hit their big top and they're going off on you and you try to tell them they're wrong, it's just going to put more fuel to the fire, and it's going to delay that their self-reflection to then retract from it. But it's really hard. And you make that decision. Do you want a righteous bully in your life or not? Like, I don't want one. I don't have any in my life. I'm the only one so far.
It's a really hard one, because what you start to recognize is that,
although I'm better now, by the way, well, disclaimer,
but I think it's a really hard one, because when you're the righteous bully, you oftentimes move from externalized righteous bully to internalized righteous bully. Right. And when you find somebody in a self-reflective phase as a righteous bully, they're oftentimes criticizing themselves and trying to fix themselves in the same way that they were just trying to fix you. And that can be a really detrimental place for them. So you have to kind of do a little check-in and be like, is this person in a self-reflective phase where they're actually willing to take on more criticism of themselves? Or are they just in a covert internalized form and I can't really tell what's going on? You know, because it's like, if I'm sitting here beating myself up about what I did and about the outburst I just had, and then you come in and you're like, yeah, you really suck at that. It might be hard for me to hear that. So
Right. I'll just say what I have in my notes too, is you want, this is kind of like, you know, preventative, try to help them with black and white thinking, try to hold their perspective gently. Like, I hear your point of view. I see your point of view. You know, this is what you're saying, right? Like, just clarify their point of view to them so that they actually understand that you're getting it. Cause I think a lot of times they feel unheard, that like, you don't actually understand what's going on. And then say, okay, now that I've got your point of view down, could I possibly, like, you want to use permissive language, could I possibly show you my point of view, or could I show you a different point of view? We don't have to agree. Like say, I still love you, even if we don't agree on this. Okay. My love for you is bigger than us agreeing on this certain topic. I think that is also really helpful, because they seem to think that conforming or agreeing with their belief system has to do with you respecting and loving them too. Right? Like, they can't separate the two. And then, you know, saying things like, our relationship is more than this fight. Would you agree? Like, I think also just kind of, sometimes they get so wrapped up in their beliefs and their theories and their argument that they lose sight of the bigger picture, which is the friendship or the relationship or the love. And maybe if they're in that heated moment, be like, I really love you. I feel like our relationship is bigger than this argument. Let's talk about it when we're both calm. I think that would also really help with the righteous bully.
I think that's good. I think you're helping them go into their heroic, you help them become their hero when you help them understand their own role in it. And you also help them understand that there can be a different opinion. And also, you know, sometimes in the heat of the moment, even just saying, is your opinion on this worth losing an entire relationship over? Is it that important for you to be right? That's a hard one, but you know.
Right. And sometimes it is.
Yeah. Sometimes it is.
Yeah. All right. Last one. Here we go.
All right. The nothing. Okay. So the nothing, the invisible destroyer, is all about, like I said, it's like the retirement part of the flower phase, in which you're struggling with what it means to be engaged with the world. You are caught so far in your head that it becomes exceptionally difficult to be able to move into the rest of your body and embodied experience. So when you encounter the nothing, you are going to probably find someone who is deeply avoidant, or they will constantly avoid questions, right? So they'll answer a question with a question. That's a classic one in my relationship. I'll just be like, how are you feeling about this? And then they'll be like, well, you were talking yesterday about how you felt about this. And in my relationship, since I'm the hungry shapeshifter, I'll be like, yeah, let's talk about me. And I'm like, what the fuck? I literally had this conversation yesterday. I was talking with my partner, And we were trying to have a conversation. And I was like, I don't want to talk about me. I want to talk about you. And I kept being like, there must have been five different occasions where he managed to deflect it back to me. And I found myself talking. And then I would literally like come out of this fugue state and be like, wait, why are we talking about me? We're supposed to be talking about you.
That's hilarious.
It's so classic me and my partner.
And any other hungry shapeshifter / nothing relationships listening.
Exactly. So the things that Anna said about somatics are doubled down in the nothing. They are extremely kinesthetic, usually in nature. And the more that you can help them feel their bodies, so whether that's through pleasure or pain or sex or breathing or whatever, that's a really good preventative for having them disappear. Like, you need to entice them back into the body as much as possible. And by touching them when you're talking to them, if they can handle that, things along those lines, it's like, it's such a kinesthetic one. And you want to remind them of their body. Luke recently got in an argument, and he had somebody facilitate, and he was in an argument with another very like intellectual person. And I didn't hear the details of it other than, they were in this facilitation with someone, and this person was getting them to go like, I poop on you. And they had to like make these like crazy big, like they were like yelling.
Oh my gosh.
I poop on you. And they were just like stomping around the room and doing all this stuff, but it worked because it was two people. One was, you know, one was running different patterns, and one was, you know, and Luke needed to get into his body, and like, and it worked, and they were able to actually like have a conversation because they just made things absurd and they made it in the body.
I love it.
Yeah.
All right. So some of the things I have notes on for working, talking to the nothing, is remind them that their presence and commitment is important. So instead of saying like, you're just disappearing again, or, you know, you just are an avoidant, you disappear in your office. Like, instead of going into the negative and like exemplifying and focusing on the nothing parts, you want to focus on their presence. Like, hey, your presence means so much. Just having you in the kitchen while I'm cooking makes me so happy. Will you just come stay with me while I'm cooking? Just, you want to let them know that their presence and their participation matters, that they are missed when they are not there. So you really want to focus on them, their presence. That's because that's what you want from them, is to be present. They need to know that if they're not somewhere, that they were missed, right? Like, yep. They need to know that.
Yep. I was just going to say, it goes both ways too. It really actually helps. Like, I'll be watching a show and kind of in my own world, and Luke will be like, what are you watching? And I'm like, oh shit, that's a bid from somebody who wants embodiment and interaction and connection. I should take that bid. Go ahead.
Okay. So another thing that I have here in my notes is that they are a little bit action-taking adverse, right? So you want to say things like, could we take a tiny step together towards X, Y, or Z? Or can we take a whisper of action towards this? Your being here changes things. You want to name their presence, and you want to make small bids for invitations.
Yeah. And also make things funny, make things like, make humor. Same with the evasive expert, both any kind of avoidant person. If you make it funny, it like brings out a really beautiful part of them that normally would be gone. Like evasive experts, it's like it disarms the situation when you make a joke out of it, right? So then you don't think, oh, this is going to be a really heavy conversation about emotions. It's like, no, it's not. It's going to be funny. How can we make this funny? Like, so much of both of those is about making jokes, making cracking jokes, not taking it seriously, because most avoidance will run when that happens.
Right. And I want to put on here, I also have written down that the nothing is the most sensitive to rejection. So more than any other one, you want to use that sandwich criticism. Like, hey, I'm going to be a compliment. I'm going to bring up very nicely the criticism. I'm going to add another compliment. That's the criticism sandwich. Definitely do that. I think when the nothings are in their over, you know, their big top, they don't lash out. They more escape. Am I right? They disappear.
They disappear.
How do you lure them back in to being not disappearing?
You normally will say, hey, let's just walk and not talk. Like, just body double with them as much as possible, right? Just like sit next to them. You don't have to talk. You're just in presence with them. crack jokes with them. If they're in a really bad place, they've hit their big top, like they're going to want to probably go away for a while. But the more that you can go with them, again, and not put any pressure on them, but just be like, you're not alone and this isn't overwhelming and we're okay. Like we can have this overwhelming conversation and still be here, the better.
Okay. Oh, okay. Are we done with that one?
Yeah. So that was amazing. Thank you for making that practical. I hope it's been as helpful for other people as possible, because as much as we would like to say it's all self-work, it is also other work in being in partnership with another person.
And if you want to send us an email and let us know how it goes for you communicating with one of your these villains using these techniques, we'd love to hear it.
Indeed. Thanks, y'all.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of This Spiritual Fix. If you are interested in finding out what your primary inner villain is, you can go to www.christinawiltse.com to take the test that is linked. That's KristinaWiltse.com. Thanks, y'all. And remember,
humility, gratitude, acceptance, done.
Hey, TSF family. So in case you weren't aware, all of you are healers. We are all healers in the way that we do the work on ourselves so that we can show up better in the world. And by doing that, we model, and every single one of you is doing that. We are all healers. We are all spreading our light. We are all addressing our shadows. And I just want to first say, way to go. I also want to say, if you feel stuck, I'm here. I do intuitive readings. I do intuitive clearings. I help the healers heal. Healing is the practice of integration in which we recognize and accept all parts of us so that we can love all parts of us. The more we love all parts of us, the more that we can love and accept and heal others. So in perpetuity, all TSF family will receive a 15% discount on their first sessions or healing sessions with me. I'm so grateful for y'all, and I hope to see you soon. Use the code TSFFAMILY, all one word, for your discount.